You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, including our Commodore class. That's Commodores Craig, Kinway, Hefe, Jennings, Drunken Dak, Two Gun Tony, The Pirate Nopales, Matthew the Navigator, Bull, Vertigon, Rumgut, and Bootstraps Bailey. And of course, our quartermasters, Samuel and Adam. Hello. Welcome to the Pirate History Podcast. My name is Matt. Thank you for listening. Last time, we talked about the Elizabethan gentlemen adventurers. Names like Richard Hawkins, William Hawkins, Walter Raleigh, George Clifford, the Earl of Cumberland, and James Lancaster. All of them were privateers and, to one degree or another, contemporaries of Francis Drake. We talked about their roles in the 1588 battle against the Spanish Armada, and the voyage that was organized by Lord Clifford to raid Spanish and Portuguese shipping in the Atlantic. When we left off, they had just received word of an incoming flotilla of large Portuguese treasure carracks headed for Flores Island. That included the largest ship in the Portuguese Navy, very possibly the largest ship in the world, Madre de Deus. Let's join them now in the Northern Azores at the beginning of August, 1592. This is episode 126, Pirates Incorporated, Part 2. That Portuguese flotilla was still a week or two away, at best. The English chose to go ashore there at Flores and see if they had anything to trade. They landed around 100 men and found the people of the town barricaded inside the church with their few guns pointed at their enemies, the English. Remember, they were at war here. But Richard Hawkins marched into the center of town holding aloft a white flag. The grandees of Flores came out to meet with him, and Hawkins made it clear that they had no intent of violence here. Instead, what they were after was food and water. If available, they would certainly trade for wine or perhaps some ale, but supplies were his mission. Now, you should remember that the Spanish Empire didn't really pay for things. They would take what they needed, and the people would be reimbursed by the crown. They would get paid, but only whatever the government thought they were owed. The Englishmen, on the other hand, had hard coin to spend. So they and the people of Flores were suddenly great friends. Over the next week, the English would occasionally bring in captives from one or another of the small ships that they captured. And they weren't after the cargo there, they were just there to make sure that the crews of those vessels wouldn't be able to carry word of their presence to the flotilla. And on some level, the people of Flores Island were complicit in that. I imagine there was kind of a fun little dance going on here. The English marching their captives into town, locking them up in a warehouse or wherever. Then one of the local leaders would come in with food, looking all sad-eyed, and say, "Oh, it's terrible, Captain. They have our women, and they took all of our money. They're eating us out of house and home. But they say that they'll leave soon, leave us alone, and that you can go free." Meanwhile, Hawkins and the mayor were busy dining together of an evening. Then again, this account is all suspect.
It's given to us by a single source, a man to whom we owe the greatest debt for this whole story, but a man who is not the most trustworthy. Richard Hakluyt was many things, a statesman, a writer, a priest even, but also a liar. He was the personal chaplain to two monarchs, Elizabeth and James I, and his writings were always in the interest of England, but not necessarily in the interest of history or truth or fact. So maybe the people of Flores were suffering. Maybe they were living under the English boot. But even if that was true, they didn't have long to worry. By 1st August, the whole fleet was mustered off the coast of Flores Island. And the command makeup of this fleet is interesting. John Burrow was the admiral. He'd been the vice admiral when the fleet left England about 2 months ago, and then the first admiral, Sir Walter Raleigh, was recalled almost immediately. The replacement for Walter Raleigh was Martin Frobisher, but Walter Raleigh split the fleet up, so even though Frobisher was technically in command of the entire armada, it was really two separate commands, with Burrow in command of one unit. Even in that case, though, Martin Frobisher had been chased back to England by a Spanish fleet just a few weeks ago. If we were to follow the chain of command, John Burrow would be the admiral, and he was by name, but there were some other very big personalities at work here. The biggest of these was Sir George Clifford, 3rd Earl of Cumberland. He was the one who'd organized the fleet. More than anyone else, he was responsible for its existence. He was the Queen's champion. He was a lord, an earl with an old and famous name, and he was a famous jousting champion. But he was here, on board the deck of a ship out in the Atlantic, because that wasn't enough. George Clifford wanted to be a privateer. He wanted to be a gentleman adventurer, which was all the rage at the time. Clifford was something of an eccentric. He took on the family title relatively young, and then very quickly gambled away most of his family fortune. He earned some of it back, entering tournaments and winning prizes. However, he was doing that down in the south. His ancestral castle in the north was falling into disrepair while he was busy jousting. In fact, that marked the beginning of the castle's fall into ruin. Now, George Clifford wasn't particularly popular with the men of the court. They found him to be braggadocious, kind of a peacocking young lord with less sense than was good for him. On the other hand, George Clifford was very popular with the women of the court. He was handsome and dashing. He was witty and funny. He was the kind of guy who was known to lose and win fortunes all on a whim. He was very, very far from the high medieval chivalric ideal, but he was still the sort of man that made nearly every lady in the court pray that he would carry her favor into the tilt. That is, of course, until the queen herself blessed him with her favor. After that, he could ask for no greater honor. Of course, there were other blessings that he hoped for from the women of the court that the queen could not fulfill. George Clifford was married, as was proper, but that didn't stop him. I imagine it's got to be fairly difficult to navigate the sexual politics of the Elizabethan court when you're the queen's champion. Certain women of the court were off limits, some of them because Elizabeth hated them. An affair with one of those ladies could be dangerous to his health, perhaps exciting, but maybe not worth the trouble. There were other women in the court that Elizabeth would politely ignore, but I mean, where's the fun in that? And then there were those who were off limits because Elizabeth was saving them for a beneficial match. I imagine that those must have been particularly exciting conquests. The lord earned some renown in the 1588 battle against the Spanish Armada, not for naval prowess, however. He brought in a number of ships to the battle, which was very appreciated by the command, and he even commanded one himself, but to no distinction whatsoever. With that in mind, it's worthy of note that on this privateering voyage into the Atlantic, he didn't have the kind of ego that would assume he was best for command. He knew that he needed an experienced commander. He knew that a privateer should be at the helm here. And that was the case with John Burrow, Martin Frobisher, and Walter Raleigh, but all the same. At least three of the ships off Flores Island were his personal property. He paid for a disproportionate amount of food and ammunition. If you were a captain on this voyage, even if you were the admiral, you'd very likely still ask his opinion. But there were other large personalities vying for attention here. The commander of the Golden Dragon, for instance. Captain Christopher Newport. Newport, in truth, deserves his own episode. And you know, he might get one someday. I love Christopher Newport, kind of in the same way that I like a character like Teddy Roosevelt. There's a fair amount of stuff in his story that should make us take pause and reflect. But there's no time, man! Not when you're facing this giant, one-armed, hook-handed, bearded pirate, the kind of guy who claps you on the back just a little too hard, the kind of guy who encourages you to drink just a little too much. You notice that your girlfriend plays with her hair a lot when he's around, and by the end of the night, he's killed a guy in a duel. But you know, it's all in good fun. And then in the morning, he's off on another adventure to the ends of the earth, ready to take a bite out of the day, and you're nursing the worst hangover of your life. Newport was the sort of sailor that walked that line between pirate and privateer for years, and at least in his youth, he was never afraid to step over that line. His earliest commands were in the Anglo-Spanish War, and he spent a lot of that time in the West Indies. He made contacts in the Americas, in both Spanish and Native American territories. He menaced Hispaniola and Cuba in the Windward Passage. And on his largest command in the West Indies, the voyage on which he captured the Golden Dragon, who would you imagine paid for a large percentage of that voyage? Sir Francis Drake, of course. It was in his honor and in the memory of Golden Hind that he christened his new ship Golden Dragon. You know, I think I am going to keep Captain Christopher Newport in my back pocket. Otherwise, this would very likely turn into an episode about Christopher Newport, and when we do talk about him, I want to give his story the time it deserves. The second Admiral of the Fleet, Martin Frobisher, was a pirate, out and out. As in, a few years before the outbreak of war between Spain and England, he was arrested and investigated on suspicion of outfitting ships for piracy. In the years leading up to the war, he operated mostly in the Spanish Netherlands, capturing mostly Spanish vessels. They weren't the kind of grandiose raids for which Drake would become so famed, but it was honest work. Or, you know, not honest work, but you get what I'm saying here. He took hauls of wine and linen, a few luxury goods here and there, maybe a bag of silver, but nothing huge. But when war broke out with Spain, located largely in his old stomping grounds in the Netherlands, his years of experience found him a place in the ranks of respectable naval commanders. You can see why Spain called England a nation of pirates. The current admiral of the fleet, John Burrow, was one of those respected naval commanders. Richard Hakluyt would write of those commanders and of Captain Burrow specifically, quote, "The gentlemen, to give them their right, were so well qualified in courage, experience, and discretion, as the greatest prince might repute himself happy to be served with their like. The honor of lieutenant general was imposed upon Sir John Burrow, a gentleman, for his manifold good and heroic parts, thought every way worthy of that command." End quote. Men who were long-time pirates and privateers suddenly qualified in courage, experience, and discretion. Remember, in the interest of England, not in the interest of history. But in the case of John Burrow, that's mostly what we have to go on. In fact, outside of this voyage, there's not much on him. John Burke's peerage lists the dates of his birth and wedding, his knighthood and his death, and all that's nice, but it hardly compares to the profiles for the other men we've talked about today. But that will all make sense in time. For now, let's turn to 3rd August 1592. Off the coast of Flores Island, the remaining English fleet waited for the arrival of 5 Portuguese carracks. They'd been informed of the incoming fleet by some liberated Barbary slaves, and they knew they were coming right their way. The fleet was spread out before Flores Island in a net that was intended to capture any Portuguese vessels on approach. The ships were all placed about 2 leagues apart, roughly 7 miles or 11 kilometers. In my mind, I imagine that as being far enough apart that they would have needed spyglasses to see one another, but that's not the case. They didn't have telescopes yet. The first verifiable telescopic patent wouldn't come around for another 16 years. And you know, Galileo would make use of them, but even then they were still the stuff of optics labs and scientific curios until the late 1600s, when Sir Isaac Newton made some serious improvements. It's unlikely that William Dampier would have had a telescope on his first few voyages, but it's entirely possible that he would have had one on his latter missions. He was kind of a science geek after all. But they didn't find any widespread maritime use until the War of the Spanish Succession. The obvious tactical advantage couldn't be ignored. What I'm getting at here is that when you picture them in your mind, they were still pretty far apart, but they weren't on the edge of the horizon. They would have to be close enough to see the nearest ship and see if they raised a flag.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Imagine a spider web with 7 spiders that were waiting to catch any passing flies. A spider web that stretched the length of Flores Island. And I say any passing flies, but let's be clear here, they were only ever really after one particularly fat fly, Madre de Dios. The 7 spiders in question were arrayed from south to north as follows. Dainty, under Captain Richard Hawkins, was the furthest south. A few leagues to the north, we find Captain Christopher Newport on Golden Dragon. Admiral John Burrow was yet farther north in Roebuck, a ship owned by the Queen. Lord Clifford's 3 vessels came next, Tiger, Samson, and Prudence in that order. And then furthest north was another of the Queen's ships, the Foresight, under Captain Robert Cross. We haven't talked about Robert Cross yet, but we will. The wind was blowing in such a fashion that it took about 2 hours to get from the location of one ship to the next. You know, there were 2 hours between Dainty and Golden Dragon. There were 4 hours between Dainty and Roebuck. By that logic, it would take a full 12 hours for Foresight and Dainty to meet, assuming that one of them stayed in place. About midday on the 3rd, a lookout on board Richard Hawkins' Dainty, the southernmost ship, spotted Madre de Dios coming their way. Hawkins sent up a flag to notify the lookouts on Golden Dragon. It worked kind of like, well, the best analogy I can think of are the beacons between Gondor and Rohan in The Lord of the Rings. And I'm sure there's a better analogy out there, but look, I just watched the whole trilogy this weekend, the extended editions even, so that's why we spent last time talking about Morgoth, and I tell you, I had to fight off the urge to talk about Shelob when we were talking about spiders and webs. But that's how it worked. After Dainty raised her flag, Golden Dragon caught wind of it and raised her own flag. Roebuck saw it and raised her flag, and then it went on and on. Within only a few minutes, all seven vessels were aware of the Madre de Dios. However, they didn't plan on the Carrick being this far south. They thought that she would come in further to the north, which meant that they would have at least two vessels that could intercept her at once, ready to fight immediately. In this situation, though, if they were to catch her, Dainty would be all alone for 2 hours. Alone against the largest and one of the most powerful ships in the whole world. Still, Captain Hawkins was no coward. Dainty sailed in to engage. Now, Hawkins had to play this carefully. Dainty was fast and well-armed for her size, but she was nothing compared to this Portuguese monster. It was going to be a delicate operation. For obvious reasons, he had to avoid getting hit, but in addition to that, Hawkins had to avoid hitting Madre de Dios too hard. I mean, it's unlikely that he could have sunk Madre de Dios, but that's not the issue here. The real issue was keeping that ship away from the shore. If you'll recall from last time, the last major ship that this fleet attempted to capture ran aground at top speed on purpose. The crew carried off all of the valuable cargo, and then they burned that ship down. If the Portuguese attempted that again, and they were likely to, this entire operation would be for naught. So Hawkins' entire job here was to keep moving, to keep himself between Madre de Dios and the shoreline. He had to keep her occupied, but at the same time he had to appear as though his ship were not too much of a threat. He did so for 2 hours, until Captain Newport arrived in Golden Dragon. Even with two ships, though, they were still in perilous danger of losing their prize, perhaps in even greater danger. Compared to Madre de Dios with her 700 men and an impressive complement of guns, Dainty was Dainty. She was nothing but a fly to be swatted away, but once Golden Dragon arrived, it showed the Portuguese captain that this could turn into a dangerous situation. He might find it imperative to make for the shore. So they danced. The English circled their prey like sharks. They fired around whenever it was safe to do so, but mostly they employed small arms fire and the swivel guns. And they focused on one particular spot on Madre de Dios, the helm. If you were trying to keep Madre de Dios from maneuvering too much or making their way to shore, the helm is where you wanted to focus your fire. Now, Dainty did take a hit in the fighting. She lost her foremast, but right about that time the Roebuck arrived to relieve her. Dainty limped off to lick her wounds, and the Roebuck and Golden Dragon continued to encircle Madre de Dios. There's something to point out here, though. Madre de Dios had a crew of over 700 men. If a crewman on board was injured or killed, or if someone grew exhausted, they had replacements. The English ships, mostly, did not. You know, it's entirely possible that Dainty could have avoided that shot that she took if the crew hadn't already been fighting for 4 hours. They might just have grown exhausted with no relief to take over. In 2 more hours, the Golden Dragon might just take a hit right about the time another ship showed up. It was possible that this pattern could continue and the English would lose. And with hindsight, we know that they had quite a fight ahead of them. Still 12 hours to go. Luckily, another ship did not take a serious hit. Over the next several hours, the firefight continued. Lord Clifford showed up with his ship Tiger, and his other two ships followed, and then Dainty, once repaired, re-entered the fight. And it was here that the whole game changed. At this point, there was virtually no question that the English could take down Madre de Dios in a straight-up fight. But they didn't want to take her down. At this point, they had to focus all of their energy on not doing too much damage here. They had to walk a tight line. See, they obviously didn't want to sink her or run her aground. They wanted to disable Madre de Dios, but they didn't want to disable her too much. They needed her to be seaworthy. They were intending to sail her back to England. If they tried to transfer all of the cargo on Madre de Dios, that would take time, and they might not even be able to fit all of that on their ship. That would give the Spanish Armada time to sail in and kill them all. If they damaged Madre de Dios too much, it would take time to repair her, which would give the Spanish Armada time to sail in and kill them all. So they played it safe. They kept their shots away from the masts. They kept their shots away from the magazine. Instead, they focused almost entirely on chain shot into the rigging and small arm fire at the helm. Let's, for a moment, look at what things would have been like on board the Carrick, specifically at the helm here. Madre de Dios was a monster of a ship, and this was in a time when ship technology was still relatively rudimentary compared to what we know and love. Optimally, it would take 12 or 14 men at the helm to steer a ship of that size. All of them were grouped up in one spot right there at the helm. Imagine standing there, straining to control this giant vessel when a hail of red-hot iron balls tears through you and your comrades. Maybe you don't take a hit, and you might consider yourself lucky, but on the other hand, the lucky might be those who took a hit through the head. Most of the men who got hit were on deck screaming and bleeding and trying to hold their insides in. In fact, maybe it's better not to imagine yourself at the helm. Maybe you're a gunner working somewhere else on the vessel, but you see what happened up there. Through the smoke, you saw showers of blood and screams. And then the orders come down, you need to get up there and work the helm. But before you can even get there and start your job, you have to help drag away the dead and dying men. And you have to do so you can take their place, to stand where they stood when that happened, to stand in the blood and the bone and the brains and the excrement. The greatest blessing you can find in all of this is that the smoke fills your nostrils so you don't have to smell that. And then once again, the English hit your position. A red-hot iron ball tears through your thigh. If you're lucky, that ball will tear through your femoral artery and you will bleed to death in only a few minutes. That cycle continued for 12 hours. The English had a vested interest in killing every man that was sent to the helm, but the Spanish had a vested interest in having men work the helm of their ship. Eventually, though, the Foresight arrived with a fresh crew and Robert Cross. Cross and Burrow and Lord Clifford all met to confer, while Hawkins and Newport kept up the fight. Those three all agreed that the firefight could not continue with any hope of successfully recovering Madre de Dios. Cross's crew was fresh. They were rested. They were ready to fight. So he volunteered to lead the boarding party. Everybody agreed to that, but Cross didn't have enough men. The best crew to back him would be the crew of Golden Dragon, Newport's men, and they went with him too. Roebuck, Tiger, Dainty, and all of the rest opened up a full bombardment on Madre de Dios. They forced the gunners of the Portuguese ship to take cover, while Golden Dragon and Foresight sailed in close. They grappled Madre de Dios, and they sent their men over the side. The fighting was fierce. There was a surge of resistance against the English, and fighting quickly spread throughout all seven decks of Madre de Dios. But the battle had already been going on for 16 hours. The fight was brief. The Portuguese were exhausted, and at least half of the Englishmen had not yet had to fight. In the hours that it took them to reach Madre de Dios from their position, many of them probably had a nap. In short order, the English held the Madre de Dios. They gathered up all of the prisoners on deck, but they did a sweep of the vessel as well. That's just good sense to make sure that nobody's hiding, make sure that nobody's planning an ambush or some sort of sabotage. But the men on that sweep who found the hold of Madre de Dios quickly realized exactly what it was that they had fought so hard for. There was more valuable cargo on board right there than any of these men had seen in their entire lives. They were all going to be rich. However, there was a somber note in the air. Richard Hakluyt writes, quote, "But albeit this first appearance of the hugeness thereof yielded sights enough to entertain our men's eyes, yet the pitiful object of so many bodies, slain and dismembered, could not but draw each man's eye to see, and heart to lament, and hands to help those miserable people whose limbs were so torn with the violence of shot and whose pain was made grievous with the multitude of wounds." No man could almost step but on a dead carcass or a bloody floor, but especially about the helm, where very many of them fell suddenly from stirring to dying. End quote. At least that's what Heklu tells us. Everyone else speaks of the orgy of plunder that followed the battle. English crewmen were stuffing their pockets and their purses with gold and rubies and sapphires. And here comes one of those moments that I truly wish I had on film. I mean, I would love actual footage of the real event, but I'd be happy with even some modern Hollywood interpretation. Not the plunder, necessarily, although I would love to see the hall all together in the holds, but no, I'm talking about the arrival on deck of George Clifford, the 3rd Earl of Cumberland, the man who paid for and organized this whole voyage. Christopher Newport and Robert Cross, the men who led the party on deck, well, they were already there, but they were busy dealing with the aftermath of battle. They were seeing to the wounded, they were seeing that everyone was taken prisoner, and that the ship was well and truly held. Clifford, on the other hand, had a deep, personal, financial interest in this voyage. How do you imagine he would react when he saw the English crewmen emerging on deck with bejimmed rings on their fingers, or pearl necklaces, or bags of nutmeg over their shoulders, with purses so stuffed with coins that they were spilling out onto the deck? Clifford was not happy. And if this were some sort of 1930s film, he would probably be all, "By Jove, sirs, in the name of your queen, cease this tomfoolery at once." And then the clouds would part, and the men would see the error of their ways and renounce piracy and become priests, maybe. In reality, the Earl probably grabbed the nearest man by the collar, pulled him face to face, and said, "What do you think you're doing?" Then he threw the man to the deck, drew his personal sword, and all of his personal retainers, knights all of them, drew their swords as well. There would have been a tense moment there on the deck, a moment in which intercompany violence was very, very possible. But of course you don't get paid if you get killed. The crew put the plunder back. There would be later estimates that would suggest that possibly as much as a third of the haul did, in one form or another, sneak away. Clifford got the crew back to work. They needed to repair Madre de Dios. They needed to get the rigging back in shape. But then he and Newport and Hawkins interviewed the Portuguese captain. Part of me is tempted to do an episode within an episode here, to play the music again and tell you, this is episode 126 and a half. The Tale of Don Fernando, because Don Fernando has one of those tales. Instead, I'll just relate what Heklut tells us. Quote, "Among the rest of those whose state this chance had made very deplorable was Don Fernando de Mendoca, grand captain and commander of this carrack, a gentleman well stricken in years, well spoken, of comely personage, of good stature, but of hard fortune. In his services against the Moors, he was twice taken prisoner. In a former voyage of return from the east, he was driven upon the sands. And although escaping the sea danger, yet fell into the hands of the infidels on land, who kept him under long and grievous servitude. The king was content to let him try his fortune on this easterly navigation, and committed unto him the conduct of this carrack, wherein he went from Lisbon, general of the whole fleet." End quote. And now, Don Fernando had been captured once again by infidels. However, George Clifford was not without sympathy. He ordered the guns on board one of his ships moved over to Madre de Dios, along with the cargo of his ship. But he left the tools and food and water on that vessel, and he gave the ship to Don Fernando, as well as the rest of the Spanish. He let them go and return home safely, weather permitting. Well, he was about to let them go. He didn't let them go yet, not until his fleet, including Madre de Dios, was well underway. The repairs were going well here, but they were under pressure. In fact, they were under several pressures. There was a rift developing between the crew and the officers, even between captains. They'd fought and they'd died for this prize, and they were privateers. They were owed a share here. But it was looking more and more like Clifford might try to deny them a share, to pay them a wage. But instead of fighting back, they worked. Because, after all, You can't get paid if you're dead. And the Spanish Armada was on its way. Next time, we're going to conclude the tale of Madre de Dios. But that's not the end of the story. This story won't end for another 3 centuries, because the capture of the Madre de Dios gave birth to something that would change the world forever. I'd like to thank everyone for listening. I'd like to thank everybody who has helped to support the show, all of our patrons on Patreon, everybody who has left us a review or a rating, everybody who has recommended this show. Without all of you, I wouldn't be able to do this. Thank you. Our theme music was, as always, The Old Captain by the band Brillig. If you haven't checked them out yet, you absolutely should do so. You can find them at brillig.com.au. That's brillig.com.au. After you're done over there, why not check out our website at piratehistorypodcast.com, or you can get in touch on Twitter, SoundCloud, Reddit, or YouTube. As always, and most importantly, thank you for listening.
Live on in legend tonight.